Hi, and welcome to this week's Expert HR podcast with me, Ellie Gelder. Now, 2P, possibly not a term that inspires enthusiasm amongst a lot of you. However, it's one of the most searched for terms on Expert HR, and it's also an area where HR can really add value to ensure that a transfer goes as smoothly as possible. In the first of our two-part podcast series on 2P, we're going to look at the practical implications of informing and consulting employees on a 2P transfer. Those responsible for informing and consulting need to be absolutely clear at the outset about what's required and the best ways of approaching it. Because as we know, getting it wrong could result in some costly tribunal claims, up to 13 weeks' pay for each affected employee. Joining me today on the phone are expert HR contributing authors and 2P specialists Patrick Brody and Kelly Thompson of law firm RPC, who are going to run through their top tips. Hi, Patrick and Kelly.
Hi, Ellie.
Hi, Ellie.
Hi. So first of all, can we just deal with the duty to consult? So what would you say your top five tips are for 2P consultation?
The first one, I would say, is one that people will think, well, that's sometimes easier said than done, but it's to plan as early as you possibly can within the context of your project and what that timetable will allow, and try to build in some wriggle room so that you have got a little bit of leeway for unexpected things that come up during that consultation process. Number two, I think it's important to remember that it's two obligations. It's an obligation to inform, which will exist on any 2P transfer, and also a separate related obligation to consult. And that second obligation to consult happens where there are any measures, any changes that are envisaged. Thirdly, I'd say you've got those 2P obligations that I just mentioned, and they're really important, but don't forget to check your contract if there is one in place, or if you or your colleagues in the legal team are negotiating a contract for your project, because oftentimes that contract will have additional obligations that build on the 2P requirements around timing, around extra information, around who pays for things that go wrong. So just make sure that you're building that into your planning as well. The fourth one, I think, is a really important one that quite often gets missed until a little bit later on in the process. And that's to make sure that you cast your information and consultation net as widely as you need to. And that means to capture everyone who is an employee that's affected or might be affected by the transfer or by any measures envisaged. And that might be more than just your group of transferring people. There might be other people in the business who are going to be impacted by that change. And then the fifth one, which I think is kind of the overarching one really, is no surprises. And what I mean by that is the best processes are the ones where you bring along the representatives and the employees with you, and that conversation is an open and ongoing dialogue rather than them being sprung with some surprises later on in the process. And when they're sprung with surprises, that's where you tend to find things break down in practice.
So essentially, it's a really good opportunity to reassure employees and to get their buy-in. But as you say, really important if you can to get everything clear so that you are consulting with the right people and you're not missing anyone out, because obviously that would presumably delays the whole thing if you've got to then go back.
Exactly.
That's right, Ellie. And in terms of the consultation itself is with appropriate representatives. So those are either going to be elected representatives, elected employees, or a recognised trade union. And oddly, the consultation obligation is not in reality with the individual employees themselves, it's with that collective body. But saying that, clearly there's real value in organisations having, to the extent that they can, or even wish to, having conversations with employees on a one-to-one basis, just to give a bit more of a flavour and a feel for both the organisation which will be taking on those employees, but also potentially what the impact of any proposals might be.
That would be done alongside the collective consultation with the elected representatives.
Absolutely. So it will be in combination. So the discussion with the employees, if they were to take place on a one-to-one basis, would be in combination with the wider collective consultation. It couldn't be an alternative to the collective consultation.
And in your sort of experience, you know, you're advising people on 2P all the time, is that often what people are doing? They are consulting on an individual basis as well as the collective obligation?
I think there's a real variation on that, and it really is driven by the organisations which are involved in that process. Some may well be taking a view that they'd much rather move through the transfer exercise more quickly, and what that then does is speak more directly to collective consultation.
Yeah.
Or alternatively, particularly if it's a large-scale transfer, there might be imperatives on both organisations to work more actively and more closely with employees to bring them along.
So it really depends on the transaction, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
So how involved should the transferee be with this consultation process? Because we've been talking about the transferor's obligations here, but what's the transferee's role?
It's a really good question, Ellie, and I think it sometimes gets forgotten, actually. So if I'm just going to deal firstly with the strict TUPE requirements, and then we'll look at it a wee bit more broadly. So under TUPE, the requirements are fairly narrow. So as the transferee, the incoming employer, you have to give information to the transferor about your measures that you envisage. So, for example, if you are going to do a restructuring, redundancy exercise, once people come across to you, that would be a measure that you would need to inform the transferor about. The only other kind of strict TUPE obligation on the transferee is if they have their own existing employees who may be affected by the influx of new people by that transaction, then they may have their own information and consultation obligation with those employees. But out with that kind of strict TUPE obligation, in our experience, 9 times out of 10, the smoothest transfer processes are the ones where there is some involvement from the transferee, where the transferor and transferee are kind of working together in that process. Because of the point we touched on earlier, that it's a hearts and minds sales exercise, really. You're about to inherit a lot of new employees, and it's hard to bring them on board if they haven't had the opportunity to look you, the transferee, in the eye and ask you directly their questions and concerns that they might have. Having said that, when we are advising on the transferor side of things, we're always keen to make sure that the transferor keeps control ultimately over the process, because these are the transferor's employees and representatives up until the point of the transfer, so they want to be sure that the process is going properly. And sometimes you'll have protections in the project contract documents to deal with kind of what happens if something goes wrong, somebody says something out of turn. And one common document that we see in lots of transactions is, and can be really helpful, is a sort of jointly agreed FAQ, frequently asked questions document, that can kick off the process and can be kind of updated as things go. And that's something that commonly the transferor and transferee would work on together, just as an example.
So just to make sure that they're consistent in what they're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, and then we've talked about the measures that the transferee may be envisaging. Presumably they communicate that information to the transferor in writing, in a measures letter?
Yes, they do, Ellie. Now, when you read the regulations themselves, oddly the requirement is merely to inform, so it's not quite as specific as saying that you have to provide a document in writing which will set out the measures envisaged by the transferee. But clearly there's real value in having a letter which effectively and properly describes the proposed measures. It's a record of what's been said and what's been proposed. It also, I think, more effectively enables the transferor, being the organisation which receives that measures letter, being able to return to its appropriate representatives to properly and fully describe what it is that the transferee is proposing to do. It also avoids any risk that there's a miscommunication between the two organisations about what the future holds for those employees.
Yeah, I can imagine if that's given verbally, there could be issues there. Presumably that doesn't happen very often, though.
Hardly ever, partly because the transferee itself will want to be able to put forward how it wishes to present the future. So there will be particular language, a particular description it would like to apply to any changes it envisaged. And equally, the transferor, quite rightly, will be saying, we ourselves need to know what it is that you propose. And having a conversation leads to often runs the risk of degrees of ambiguity.
Sure, so it's a good opportunity for the transferee to kind of, as you say, put the case forward. So getting the tone right is really important. So if no measures are proposed, then is it okay for representatives to be given the information right before the transfer, day before the transfer?
I'm going to give a really boring lawyer's answer.
Okay.
Because I'm a really boring lawyer. It's legally risky because of a slightly painful piece of case law. The information obligation under TUPE is to give the information that TUPE requires to the representative in good time before the transfer to enable meaningful consultation. And so that's kind of a fluid timeline, and you can see by the way it's defined, it depends on what the consultation process is going to be. If that's going to be difficult and detailed and there are lots of changes, then clearly you need to start it sooner, so you need to give the information sooner. But if you've got no measures whatsoever at all, there's no changes, which is rare in practice, but it does happen. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you've got no consultation obligation. You might think reasonably, well, we'll just give it the day before, actually, because they've had it. There's no consultation and job done. Mm-hmm. But there was a case that said, actually, in that scenario, you still should give the information with a period that would have enabled consultation had you had the obligation to consult. So you've got to kind of, it's like a hypothetical period. I think where you've got absolutely no measures, I would still say, give at least a week if you can. If the project timetable doesn't allow for that, you might, as an organisation, take the view that actually nothing's changing. How likely are individuals to raise an issue if we give it the day or two before? And that's always a judgment call to make. But always bear in mind not just the strict legal obligation and that case that I mentioned, but also how is it going to go down with staff and representatives if they're only finding out about this the day before it happens.
Yeah.
There's lots in the balance in deciding that.
Yeah, it's common sense really as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Consultation, provided it that obligation applies, how long should that whole process last?
Unusually, particularly as compared to collective redundancy consultation with TUPE, there isn't a fixed time period. So when we think about collective redundancy consultation, then there are defined periods, 30 or 45 days. TUPE consultation is different because what it speaks to is conduct and behaviour with regard to that consultation. And it simply says that consultation has to be undertaken in good faith with a view to reaching agreement. And there is no time period beyond that.
So with a view to reaching agreement, what sort of things do you mean?
Yeah, so as Patrick was saying, it says with a view to reaching agreement, so you don't have to actually agree ultimately the organisation decides when to kind of call an end to the process. But what you need practically is to allow time to share your proposals with the representatives, to take their feedback, to let them get feedback from their constituent employees, to consider those comments, respond, deal with any new matters that come up. So there's a kind of give and take within there. And how long that takes is really going to depend oftentimes on the exact measures that are proposed. So if you've got a major restructuring to consult about, that's probably going to take longer than more kind of minor changes to sort of ancillary policies and things.
Yeah.
But having said that, don't assume that what looks seemingly minor on paper will be taken as a small thing by representatives. You know, things like a change in payroll date might seem like an administrative change, but that can actually be huge for individuals because their mortgage payments and all the rest of it are based on that. So those kind of things can take longer than you might envisage on paper. And the other thing to mention is it also hinges on the practicalities, like how quickly can you get people together to have a meeting? Is this happening over Christmas, in which case you're going to have to feed in a few extra weeks just because no one's around? If they're existing representatives, particularly union representatives, what's your relationship like with them? Is it constructive? Is it adversarial? How is that going to impact on it? And how engaged is everyone going to be, both those representatives but also the transferor and the transferee, and how can you practically get everybody together? So it's feeding all of that into your early planning, which goes back to my first tip about building in some wriggle room to allow for those sorts of nuances.
Sure, allowing yourself to have that dialogue. So finally, can you just talk us through what happens where there aren't any appropriate representatives? So, for example, you're a small business.
Well, with small businesses, and by small businesses, that means organisations with 9 or fewer employees, there's a defined exception to consultation within TUPE. And what that exception says is if those small organisations don't have appropriate representatives or elected employees, what they can do is they can have consultation and a conversation with employees themselves directly. So there is an exception to that. It's also worth bearing in mind that not all transfers are going to be transfers impacting on large numbers of people. Some are relatively small, so you may well be looking, even for large organisations, only looking at a handful of people moving. And in those circumstances, there's nothing to stop an organisation from seeking to have conversations and consultation with individual employees rather than electing representatives.
Yeah, because that would be disproportionate, wouldn't it, if there's only a few people affected?
And equally, in those circumstances, individuals, given the small number of people, want to have a direct conversation. So if you are looking at relatively small transfers, sometimes what organisations will do is go back to the affected employees and say, you have this right to elect a representative or representatives from amongst your body. If you wish to exercise that right, please do. But it's available then for those employees to decline that offer. And if they're given a reasonable time in which to decline it and do decline the offer, then the organisation can have direct conversations with those individuals without the machinery of collective consultation.
But probably get that in writing.
And again, with so much of this having it, confirmed by email, by letter.
Well, thanks very much, Patrick and Kelly.
Thanks, Ellie, and very much looking forward to catching up with everyone next week.
Thanks, Ellie.
Thank you. So hopefully now our listeners will feel more confident at dealing with their information and consultation obligations in a practical way, and importantly, avoiding any nasty, costly claims for failing to inform or consult. If you'd like to view more detailed guidance, do take a look at our resources on Tupi, which you'll find all in one place on the Tupi topic page. And that brings us to the end of this week's podcast. As Kelly and Patrick just mentioned, they'll be with us again next week for the second part of our podcast series, and they'll be talking to us about two tricky areas of Tupi law. First of all, how you can go about harmonising terms and conditions post-transfer, and secondly, how to handle dismissals in a Tupi situation. So definitely one not to miss. Until then though, it's goodbye from us.